Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
You just can't keep moving people around and shuffling them around without good reason until you have a shelter space.
A recent court decision did little to clear up the question of when and how Anchorage can clear homeless camps. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, food prices in Kodiak are among the highest in the nation.
We'll continue to have high prices relative to other parts of the country for the same reason we have for a long time.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Operators of Alaska child care centers say they are having trouble finding staff to meet high demand. That includes operators on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, where staffing constraints mean centers are able to serve just under 400 children, a fraction of their capacity, says Heather Weifer, flight chief for child and youth programs on base.
So that's 50% of our capacity is being met. And we have 266 military members that are on the wait list, and 30 of them are single and active duty military members.
Weifer was one of several people who presented challenges during the second meeting of Governor Mike Dunleavy's Task Force for Child Care conducted by Zoom today. Dunleavy formed the group earlier this year to come up with a plan to improve access and affordability of child care in the state. Weifer represents the perspective of military child care facilities on the task force. Another member, Jenny Taylor, works for the Bunnell House in Fairbanks, a child care center partnered with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's concerned about how much families must pay for child care. While the university helps pick up some of the costs, Taylor says families are having trouble qualifying for help from the state.
I currently don't have any families that qualify for child care assistance. I do have one that qualifies for their tribal child care assistance, but that's totally different and separate from the state child care assistance program.
State officials heard from tribal child care representatives as well. Bridie Trainer is child care program director for Kerwerik, a tribal nonprofit based in Nome. She says there are very few licensed providers in the region and says the state could do more to help tribes.
We've demonstrated the need for tribes to have the ability to license themselves. I'm really hoping that that the state will create new regulation to defer to tribal standards and, you know, make giving us access as well to those state funds.
State Health Commissioner Heidi Hedberg says the initial meetings of the task force are to take a broad glance at child care across the state. She says the next two meetings, held every 2 weeks, will focus on background checks and licensing issues. A federal appeals court recently reaffirmed a landmark decision that outlined when local governments cannot enforce anti-camping laws against the homeless. That's unlikely to have any practical effect in Anchorage, even as city officials work on expanding and clarifying its policies for clearing some unsanctioned campsites. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
Punishing people for camping outside when they have nowhere else to go remains unconstitutional in the federal court system's Ninth Circuit, which includes Alaska. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals recently decided not to take up a case that threatened that precedent, and Anchorage officials continue to tread lightly around how and when they will clear unsanctioned homeless encampments. Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson, speaking on political blogger Jeff Landfield's podcast recently, said he wouldn't fight the underlying decision.
It wasn't that bad of a decision. It's created problems, but as what it does, it says you can't punish the status of being homeless. And it says, and you just can't keep moving people around and shuffling them around without good reason until you have a shelter space.
Lawyers for the city and the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska agree that good reasons do exist that justify clearing some camps, even when Anchorage's shelter spaces are full, which they are. Homelessness experts estimate roughly 700 people are unsheltered in the city. But the lawyers don't agree on specifics, and the latest court decision didn't clear those up. Ruth Botstein is the ACLU's legal director. She says the facts around the latest case and court opinion add some new legal wrinkles, but none that seem to be relevant to Anchorage.
So I think in the big picture, that's right. It doesn't change the constraints that the municipality is operating under right now.
The ACLU represented Anchorage campers who fought two of the Bronson administration's attempts to clear large encampments this summer. One case became moot when the city suspended its effort. The other court challenge is still live, though the vast majority of campers did leave that site. Bronson's homelessness coordinator, Alexis Johnson, says the city doesn't have any other imminent plans for clearing large camps. Last month, municipal attorney Ann Helzer told the Anchorage Assembly that there are three limited circumstances where she thinks the city is within the bounds of federal case law to clear camps, even when shelter spaces are full.
One, areas that are closed to the public. Two, where exigent circumstances posing a serious risk to human life or safety exist. Three, where the municipality is working to maintain accessibility, such as our obligation to be ADA compliant.
The city's legal department has been working on a policy to clarify and slightly expand when it will enforce no camping rules. Municipal attorneys said the draft policy's publication was imminent in mid-May, but it's still not out. By Wednesday afternoon, they had not responded to questions about the timeline. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans flock to Anchorage to see Antiques Roadshow live.
I brought a kayak with a hunter in it. He's got his gut rain suit on.
I brought my Beatles wallet.
Antiques coming up. Stay with us. Most Alaskans can attest to paying a lot at the grocery store. But data released last week by Alaska's Department of Labor and Workforce Development suggests food prices in Kodiak could be the highest in the country. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports.
State economists studied survey data from last year that compared the costs of living in more than 200 communities across the country. The survey looked at six categories, and Kodiak topped the list nationwide for two out of the six, groceries and healthcare. Dan Robinson is the research chief for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. He says, on the whole, there's less of a gap between the cost of living in Alaska compared to the lower 48 than there used to be.
Broadly, the costs for Alaskans since the 80s have come down relative to the rest of the country. That doesn't mean they're less expensive here.
Robinson says it's hard to put a finger on why healthcare costs are so much higher in Kodiak, but groceries come down to location. Kodiak, like many other places in the state, has a relatively small population and has to ship in nearly all its food. Add in COVID-caused supply chain problems and inflation, which reached a 41-year high in the state last year, and prices have soared even higher. Kodiak can't officially claim the number one spot for food costs, though. The survey doesn't include every community in the U.S., and it only includes data from four cities in Alaska: Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Kodiak, which all had higher costs than the national average in each of the categories surveyed. Robinson says it's not all bad news, though.
Our inflation, like the nation's, is coming down. It's still higher than average, but it's coming down.
That being said, sheer logistics means some things, like groceries, will likely stay more expensive in Alaska.
Nobody should think that in the next 2 years, their bag of groceries in Kodiak is going to cost the same amount as it does in Bend, Oregon. We'll continue to have high prices relative to other parts of the country for the same reason we have for a long time.
Meanwhile, Alaskans will just have to keep eating the costs. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobroth.
Alaska has a lot of wilderness, for sure, and plenty of people who like to adventure in it. Sometimes those adventures go wrong, though, whether through failures of gear or navigation, not to mention the unpredictable weather and large wild animals. Wilderness safety instructor Deb Iyango says adventurers can also make mental mistakes that, in some cases, can make an uncomfortable situation much worse. And Iyango says the preparation to avoid making mental mistakes should start long before someone ventures into the wilderness.
Ideally, anything you do is going to be sequential learning, right? So if you're going to build a tent, you're going to learn how to build a tent. You're going to learn how to use a stove. I mean, ideally, might do it inside, but then I want you to do it outside in bad weather. But once we start having things like wind, or it's a little different than what you remember, it's a new tent, it's a new stove, it's like, once you start adding those, you know, different factors, now you're going to start adding various stressors, and they ultimately accumulate, right? So they're going to make a difference in the field so that sooner or later, you will reach a threshold. We just add a little more, we add a little more, we add a little bit of elevation, a little more risk. People like that. But Alaska often has far more risk, more hazards, greater hazards, and a much smaller margin of error, right? So you just can't afford to make big mistakes up here, right? It's a pretty unforgiving country.
What are some of the reasons that people make mistakes in those situations or put themselves in that position of not maybe thinking clearly?
Commonly, you will overestimate your own abilities, right? You will underestimate the hazard. Very commonly, contributing factors are going to be things like there was some sort of a deadline in there, a time factor. Maybe a piece of equipment is missing, or there's something about equipment in there. But then we just say those are contributing factors. And with everything that's happening, you're juggling many, many balls. There was too much going on, right? And there were too many stressors going on. It's like it's pretty common, right? About 85% of people underperform in those high stress situations. Let's say it's a number 10. You can function with 10 units of stress, but once you get to 11, you're not going to do well. So the lack of sleep might be a 2. The lack of water might be a 1. The rain might be a 1. We just keep adding it up, and you're pretty stressed. But now all of a sudden, this bear attacks or this bear charges or whatever. But if you're already at a 7, right, it's like, ooh, it puts you over the limit. Now what happens to the brain? We kind of have two brains. So the inside brain is what I'm going to call the limbic system. It's the automated system. It's the breathing, the heart rate. And that's also the amygdala. It's your emotions too. The outside of the brain, that's your prefrontal cortex. That's your decision making. That's making sense of stuff, future thinking, goals. Your brain will resort to habits in an emergency. It doesn't like to use the prefrontal cortex. And so you want your response, your habitual routine response, to be a very effective habit. You want to sleep with your headlamp at the same place next to you every single night, right? You want your bear spray to be at the same place. And if you can create these habits, then when things are highly stressful, you will do your routine.
And with the bear spray in particular, I mean, a bear charging you seems obviously stressful, but even just like using the bear spray can be stressful too, right? Can you tell me about that?
Using bear spray for the first time is new, right? You've never done it. So you might even see me do it, but I say, here, for real, Casey, take this, take it outside, and I hand it to you. And I say, go ahead and use it. And I mean, almost always people will look at me and they'll go, really? And I can tell you've just had a dose of adrenaline, haven't you, right? And you can even almost probably visualize it yourself, right? I say, right. No, for real, like, take the safety off right now, and everybody's going to watch you, and I want you to spray it. And you're like, really? And I say, if right now this is slightly stressful, imagine what it's going to be like when the bear is charging you, right? Then that makes sense. Then the brain's never going to want to add stress to the situation. So it's like, you've got to think this through ahead of time. So let's take the safety off. Let's spray it. Let's see it. Let's hear it, because it's going to make a sound. It's going to actually have kind of colorful gas. Think of like driving home, right, and doing something else. You say, I didn't even remember getting home. I drove home automatically because it became automated, right? The limbic system has very few things it can do in automation, and you can actually do it automated while you're thinking. That's what we want to do with all of your emergency skills, is make them automated so that you can actually drive home while doing something else.
Maybe you're driving home thinking about the bear encounter.
Yeah, that's right.
I imagine when you do have a chance to reflect on those things, it probably helps with preparation for whatever your next trip is, right? And kind of being mentally tough or being mentally prepared, I imagine, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully you reflect on it, right? Hopefully you actually learn something from it. The people who just kind of brag about their mistakes, I'm not so sure. But generally speaking, for two reasons. Number one, in the event of any highly stressful situation, the brain is going to look for anything similar it's experienced in life. Right? I've been in inclement weather. I've been in this, you know, and it might not be exactly the same, but it's like, oh, I've seen this. I remember this one. So in that regard, that's great. But the second thing is what the brain does then is it can either decide if it was a really, really bad event, right? Then you can become hypervigilant and it's afraid. And then the amygdala can actually grow. And it's like, oh, I never, ever, ever want that to happen again, right? So that's somebody who's had a super traumatic event. A lot of times that people will think of like post-traumatic stress, all this. But generally speaking, it was just a little bit traumatic, right? So we say, okay, well, that's a good learning opportunity. Not only is the brain going to reflect, what the research has shown is that reflecting inside of your brain is going to help in one regard, but actually saying it out loud is going to be a different type of reflection because you'll hear it from yourself. And then it also helps the brain develop resiliency and grit.
That was Deb Ayongo, who teaches outdoor and remote work environment safety through her business, Safety Ed. You can find her at safetyed.net. The public TV show Antiques Roadshow filmed in Anchorage yesterday at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. It's the first time the popular show has visited Alaska. Alaska Public Media is a PBS member station and broadcasts the show. Nearly 2,500 people showed up with items to be appraised by experts in various specialties. But as Alaska Public Media's Ammon Swenson reports, for the most part, the real value for the show and the audience is the story behind the object.
Cheyenne Beatty is standing behind a folding table under a tent at the Alaska Native Heritage Center discussing an attendee's finely detailed indigenous footwear laid out on its wrapping.
He always brings me a gift. It's cool.
So this was gifted to you. I'd say that you have a really nice friend.
Oh, yeah. And you know.
Beatty's working as a local appraiser at the Tribal Arts Booth. Some of her favorite items she's seen were a carved killer whale tooth from King Island, a seal gut doll, and a Yupik basket adorned with goose feathers and feet. Beatty says she's watched the show for years and is glad to be a part of it.
It's validating, I think, for a lot of locals to have the Antiques Roadshow to come to Alaska.
The longest line was consistently for the Tribal Arts Booth, but people brought everything from family heirlooms to garage sale finds. One guest named Brenda, Antiques Roadshow won't let us use her last name, brought her grandfather's teddy bear that she thought could be worth something because it was from a valuable toy maker. It looked beyond well-loved and was tattered and worn. While the bear did turn out to be genuine, she found out the overall wearing bear was hiding a secret.
Apparently he's Frankenbear. His head was decapitated and put on backwards, so he's my sweetheart. So 1910, he's old and well-loved, so that's Teddy.
Other people brought stuff like musical instruments, paintings, furniture, jewelry.
I brought a tiny little tribal statue that I bought at a garage sale, a huge sapphire ring in a platinum setting surrounded by diamonds.
I brought a kayak with a hunter in it, and he's got his gut rain suit on.
I brought my Beatles wallet that my grandmother gave me, two plates that I bought at a garage sale on the hillside, and my husband brought fly rods.
I brought two carvings, one by Pat Dixon and one by Pat McGuire from British Columbia.
Attendees were bused from the Bartlett High School parking lot and taken to the Alaska Native Heritage Center. Then they went through a general sorting process the staff refers to as triage. Depending on what two items they brought, they might be ushered outside to various locations around the center to the paintings and drawings table or the dolls table where an expert waits to appraise their objects. Alaska is the last stop of five cities Antiques Roadshow filmed for the next season. Senior producer Sam Farrell says you never quite know what things you'll see in any given region.
As somebody once said, you know, you can see a Hawaiian bowl in Boston and a Boston chest in Hawaii.
The appraisers and producers work together to determine which combinations of people and their objects will make the final cut, but only a very small percentage of the 2,000-plus attendees will be on the show. Coordinating the production is a huge undertaking requiring hundreds of staff and volunteers. The added logistics to shoot in and travel to Alaska are complex and has prevented the show from coming to the state so far. Tote Maritime donated their shipping services, which allowed the show to get two semi-trucks worth of specialized gear to Alaska. Antiques Roadshow is currently airing their 27th season and is the most watched show on public television.
So I think that's the ultimate secret sauce, is that people like learning in a way that they don't even notice. It feels like eating ice cream.
Marsha Bemko has been the executive producer since 2003 and says that when you boil it down, they're telling people about what they own, appraising it, and making TV from it. It's a simple formula, but she says it's not just about the items.
But ultimately, behind those things are people. And when you do this show like that over the years, you really get touched by people and the humanity of people and how we're all the same. We all care about the same things, and I like that.
The Anchorage Filming will produce 3 one-hour episodes of Antiques Roadshow premiering in the first half of 2024. In Anchorage, I'm Ammon Swenson.
If you were raised in America, the 4th of July might feel special, but certainly familiar. What if you weren't born in the USA, though? Well, KFSK sent Thomas Copeland, the station's resident Irishman, into downtown Petersburg last week to cover his very first Independence Day.
Well, it's 8:30 in the morning, so it's time for me to find out what a Petersburg 4th of July is all about. And I want to do it all in the time that it takes to play a classic all-American tune. Alexa, play Born in the USA.
Well, the first stop has to be the 4th of July parade downtown. The theme, Let Freedom Ring. Near the front was Pat Blair on his custom-built extra-tough bicycle.
In support of the Petersburg Bike Park, as are all the kids riding behind it. Every kid that shows up gets a bell.
A rollerblading Matthew Garretts with Starflower, the blind duck, in a star-struck wheelbarrow spangled with stars and stripes.
Do you have high hopes of winning today, Starflower? I'll take that as a yes.
The Olsen and Eddie families dressed as wrestlers and referees, ready to wave from their wrestling ring trailer.
We've got Tough as Nails, Teddy Roosevelt, Warrior Woodrow Wilson, Body Slammin' Ben Franklin, and Mayhem Abraham Lincoln.
Are you guys excited for 4th of July?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you had a lot of fun already?
Yeah.
Do you think you might be in with a shot of winning?
Yeah.
Do you answer yes to every question?
Yes.
Are you going to fight each other?
No. Yes. They won't allow it.
Why won't you allow them to fight?
You know, moms have to put safety first.
But the lack of adolescent violence certainly didn't dampen the crowd's enthusiasm. They cheered on for every single float, especially those tossing candy to the kids. But here in America, competition is king, and there can be only one winner. This year's victor, a mock boat float fishing for kids dressed as fish, celebrating the opening of the King Salmon Troll Fishery following a prolonged legal battle. Its name, Let Freedom Ring for Trollers, made by...
our neighborhood at Sandy Beach. Let's
Sandy Beach neighbor Sue Paulson accepted the trophy and $200.
We're all in support of our trollers.
And where's this trophy going to go? How are you going to decide who keeps it?
You know, there's going to be a big battle, and I predict that I am going to win at first, but I will share later.
Well, the parade is over, and we're nearly 2 minutes through on the Springsteen countdown, so it's time for a pit stop.
Right, so it's just around lunchtime now. That means I need some food. But not just any food, I need to find the most American food.
We're doing teriyaki salmon bowls, corn dog.
How good do they taste?
I'm not the person to ask, I can't eat them.
Why not?
Because they have gluten in them.
Deep fried blue shell crab.
Cake donuts?
Are they good for you?
No.
If I want to eat the most American food, what should I eat?
First thing we're going to do is get you a dog and a bun. All right, what do we got here is a little bit of jalapeno, if you'd like some of that. Cheese, onion, ketchup, little bit of mustard. All American hot dog, look at that.
I'm going to take a bite.
Oh. Oh, wow. Do you like it?
I love it.
All right. That's why we're up to cooking 200 of these so far today.
Stuffed full of food, and with just a few minutes left on our tuneful timer, let's head down to the harbour for two of Petersburg's most high-profile events. First up, the blindfold rowboat race. On the dock, Mickey Ramos and Trent Ellis have worked out a foolproof strategy.
I'm going to yell at him a lot, and he's going to do exactly what I say. It always has worked, and it's going to work again today or else.
How confident are you feeling?
Not very.
Super confident.
And Ramos's confidence was justified. A chart-topping 46 seconds on the board. But they're not out of the water yet. Reigning champions Joe Vicnicki and Cynthia Mattison are up next.
Go!
And they're off. Reigning champ Joe and Cynthia, there's a little bit bumpy to start. Probably not getting the pace that they wanted to get at this stage. Oh, they're moving in the wrong direction. Oh, and the oar's broken. The oar has been broken, ladies and gentlemen. It's unprecedented. The oar has snapped. Joe Vicnicki has snapped the oar. Such was his enthusiasm at the game.
Back on dry land, Vicnicki had to admit his nerves.
Joe, did the pressure just get too much?
Oh, man, where did they get these oars from? Are they wrangle oars?
Whether from the pressure or a dodgy wrangle oar, the team's second attempt soon derailed.
Oh, and he's lost it entirely. He's lost it entirely, ladies and gentlemen.
With that, Ramos and Ellis were heralded the 2023 Blindfold Rowboat Champions. and that left just one competition still to play, the iconic Petersburg 4th of July log roll. Long-reigning log-rolling champ Britton Eriksen, from a proud family of log-roll victors, is unfazed by the jealous gaze of the competition.
I mean, I do have people downtown, like, tell me I'm going down, and I'm like, I don't even know who you are.
One by one, the brave men and women who took to the log splashed into the water and out of the game. Anna Early, another former champion, took victory for the ladies, and Britton Eriksen secured the men's title. But here in Petersburg, only one log-roller can reign supreme. And so, a true battle of the titans began.
The grand final. Britton looks in control at the moment. Anna nearly slipping there, and she's down! Britton Eriksen is the champion, men and women. He's won the whole thing yet again. Britton, how do you feel?
A little cooler than I was about 10 minutes ago.
Final thoughts, are you pleased?
It was just a great 4th of July. The parade was awesome, and all the events downtown were great. It's just been a great weekend.
And with that, the end of Petersburg's 4th of July from the Middle Harbour in Petersburg. I'm Thomas Copeland.
Well, that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early, Jeremy Shea and Ammon Swenson in Anchorage, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, and Thomas Copeland in Petersburg. Congratulations on surviving your first Independence Day in America. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.